Welcome to another episode of the Waters and Harvey Show. I am Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
And as always, Marcus and I are enthused and happy to have you all back here with us again in the audience for another episode of the show. We continue to enjoy the time that we spend with you all, continue to enjoy the feedback that we get from you all. One of the things that you will know is that maybe just about a year ago, Marcus, I think we did a show in reference to a project that is happening down, you know, not far from here in the Oakport area, the rail project. And when we did that show, we opened that show with a quote from Lewis Hyde's book, A Primer for Forgetting was the title of that book. And Marcus, you'll probably recall that we quoted him as saying that we live in a culture that prizes memory, but recent conversations about American historical memory have revealed that there are components of our history that has either been forgotten, hidden, or sometimes just plain ignored. And this has been an ongoing conversation, Marcus, that you and I have had, talking about historical memory, what we choose to remember, what we seem to not want to remember and what we want to forget, and how we construct memory. But this has just been an ongoing conversation between you and I and our audience.
Yeah, it's been an ongoing conversation. And I think the fact that we have found it necessary to continue to have this conversation is a reflection of the difficulty that the country has with remembering, right? With the practice of remembering its history in a way that is honest, right? In a way that is all-encompassing, wide-ranging, and in a way that really does justice to those stories that over the course of American history have been overlooked, ignored, swept under the rug because they don't fit a certain national sense of identity. And so I think, you know, this conversation is important to revisit. And, you know, my hope is that it, over time, it will have the effect in broader society of sort of forcing or challenging Americans to reevaluate or reassess how they remember.
Right. It's so remarkable. That's true. Yeah. For me, you know, as a professional historian, it's what we do. It's what I do for a living. So I'm all in when it comes to talking about history and memory and how we remember things. Now, I have been challenged recently by this book by Lewis Hyde that we just referenced, A Primer for Forgetting. And I've been really challenged by another book called In Praise of Forgetting, which is talking about, okay, this effort that we put on remembering things, how about we put some effort on maybe getting beyond, especially some of the pain of the past. But one of the things I would also say there that I think you and I have said this in recent conversations, that in order for us to really get beyond some of the pain of the past, we have to first deal with it, right? So being bold and courageous enough to deal with some of these painful parts of our story, of our national story, I think is important. In that earlier show, Dr. Dan Pierce, who is a really good friend and colleague, was our guest to talk about this project. He's going to be joining us again today with another member who has been working as a part of that project, Mr. Steve Little, who is the mayor of Marion. And we're going to be bringing them into the conversation in just a few minutes to talk a little bit more about what is going on with this project. But one of the things that we do want to acknowledge is the interest that you all in the audience have really shown in this project, because a number of people have commented to me about how much they really enjoyed that earlier show. Now, the reality is that anytime Dan Pierce is on the show, people are going to enjoy it because he's such a good storyteller. You get drawn into these stories. And so people were talking about that. One person I want to mention here, Marcus, is, you know, a new member of this community, has been here for a while. Kurt Swinson, who is at UNC Asheville as Vice Chancellor of Advancement. Kurt pulled me to the side and said, look, you know, this was a really good introduction to living in this region here in Western North Carolina and some of the rich history that is here. He even told me that his son thoroughly enjoyed that conversation, especially when you're talking about the railroad and riding the rails. So it's great to know that you all are getting so much from the show. And I know you feel the same way, Marcus.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just encourage people to continue to explore the stories that we feature on the show, because mm-hmm. because in almost every case, they are stories that have not received the attention that they deserve. So mm-hmm. they're certainly worthy of further investigation.
Right. So it's great that you and I were saying in that earlier show that one of these hidden stories was the story. Well, not so much hidden, but it's just a story that people were not familiar with, mm-hmm. with the laborers who helped to build the Western North Carolina Railroad and how important the completion of that railroad was to the development of this region. And Marcus, I can't, before we move on, I can't help but think about the centennial anniversary of what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I think that I was shocked as I listened to stories on other radio programs about commemorating that and remembering what happened in Tulsa, and how many people who had even grown up in Tulsa, Oklahoma had no idea that this event had ever occurred. So I think, Marcus, it buttresses the point that you and I make, that there's so much that we still don't know about our historical experiences.
Yeah. And I think if there may be no better time in the country's history than now to really sort of prick people and invite them in a challenging way to really confront these stories, right? Mm-hmm. Even though they have been largely ignored over mm-hmm. the course of history. So, I think now, perhaps there's no better time than now, right?
To
remember what happened in Tulsa, to talk about the Mountain Division of the Western North Carolina Railroad and the incarcerated laborers whose mm-hmm. labor was vital to the completion of that project, which, as you pointed out a moment ago, really was essential to the development mm-hmm. of this part of the state. So,
right. And let me say this too, Marcus, and then we'll bring Dan and Steve into this conversation with us about this project. But one of the things that I would love for people, our fellow citizens in this community across the state of North Carolina and the country at large to be thinking about is that 5 years from now, we will be commemorating the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, and all of the ideas that are embodied in that document. And I think that if we look at our history, while there have been fits and starts and there have been these painful pieces of our experience, I can't help but think of Ralph Ellison, who has said that it has been people of color largely and people who have been oppressed. And it's not just people of color. I think, Marcus, of the story of Homestead in Pennsylvania and the laborers there and how they were taken advantage of early on as America was industrializing in the late 19th century. But thinking about those ideas and how we have been pushing and moving the needle. There's work that still needs to be done, but you and I have been asking in this latest series of shows that we've been doing two major questions. Who are we and who do we want to be? And I think that those are important questions for us to be thinking about as we move towards the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. So with that said, Marcus, let's bring Dr. Pierce and Mr. Steve Little into this conversation. Dan, it's good to have you back. And Steve, it is wonderful to have you join us today. How are the two of you doing?
Great, Darren. Thank you. What a treat it is and an honor to participate in your show.
We're so happy to have you here. And I know that you have a busy schedule. So the fact that you could take the time to kind of join us today, I think is a real treat for both Marcus and me. Dan, how is it going on your end?
It's good. We're back in school here at UNC Asheville in person. So as weird as that is, Marcus, I know so far so good. So happy to be back.
And Marcus, I can't help it. I have to ask Dan, how does it feel to be back with students? I mean, Marcus and I talked about this earlier, nearly a year and a half. I mean, we were teaching virtually, but Marcus has already said, and Marcus, please feel free to jump back in here, that you're really glad to be back in the classroom. But, I had to take a punch at Marcus in an earlier show to say, yeah, that's because he's such a showman. And, he was looking for a captive audience, right?
No. I was just saying, Dan and Steve, that, I taught remotely for the past academic year, and I had gotten accustomed to that, and I wasn't really sure what the experience of returning to the classroom, you know, in, you know, amidst what is an ongoing pandemic would be like, or how students would respond to that. But much to my surprise, thus far, you know, students have been not only engaged, but it seems to me eager to be back in the classroom and to engage with professors and among themselves. And so, I would say that the semester's off to a good start, even though that start is a risky one. So, but Dan, you know, I wonder what your experience has been thus far.
No, that was the word that jumped to my mind is with the students was eager. There is a real eagerness to kind of have some normalcy. Normality in their lives and get back and those face-to-face. It was funny today. I had a small group meeting with some senior thesis students, and I saw this student sitting in the hall, and he was wearing a mask, and I didn't recognize him. But then he walks into my office, and I realized it was a student that I'd known for, you know, since last January. But he was much taller than I expected him to be. I'd never seen him in person.
So, Steve, you know, you're down in Marion over in McDowell County. How are things in Marion? I mean, are people wanting to get back to normal? Are they finding that difficult to do? And how are you all navigating through that process?
Oh, I think the word used already, eager, still applies to us as well. One thing that we're anticipating in just a couple of weeks is another iteration of the Bigfoot Festival in downtown Marion. Oh. And I have to tell you, I'm a little bit apprehensive. It's going to be on a Friday afternoon and all day on Saturday. The last time we had this, we had approximately 40,000 people to downtown Marion.
Wow.
The pandemic as it is now, I doubt there'll be that many people, but there are so many who are so eager to come out. They might take excessive risks, who knows, but we're doing the best we can to try to stay healthy, try to encourage people to be vaccinated, encourage people to wear their masks, even though it's not convenient and not cool looking. It's healthy.
Yeah, and Steve, just a quick question. I didn't know about this Bigfoot Festival.
Oh,
Darren mentioned earlier that you're a historian. Do you know how long this has been a thing in Marion?
Well, I can tell you this would be the third annual Bigfoot Festival, so it's
relatively new.
As a festival, we had to skip last year. It would have been the fourth, but oh my goodness, it is very popular. I was on a radio show a few days after our first one with a host in California. And he was saying, you know, of course, that the real Bigfoot is in the Sierra Mountains of California. And I said, well, you know, his first cousin is in the Blue Ridge Mountains in McDowell County. Goodness. So we had a good time talking about that.
Well, you know, I'm going to, materializes, I want to come down to this festival at some point, Steve. I really want to have this experience.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but you know, if we're thinking, I think that this is a good segue into the topic of our topic for the show, talking about a Bigfoot or a Bigfoot print. The Western North Carolina Railroad has a major, major footprint in this region of the state. It was so important. And we were talking about that in that last show that we did with Dan and the construction of the Western North Carolina Railroad. And Dan gave us a really good sense of, you know, the labor and what went into actually bringing that railroad up the Blue Ridge Mountains of Western North Carolina and the labor that was involved. And I've written about this in my own work about the African-American laborers who were at the time identified as convict laborers. And, you know, there's so much that is packed in that in and of itself. And it prompted this wonderful project to memorialize these workers, these laborers, people who had been involved in this. And Dan, I just want to, and for both you and Steve, just to go back to the basic question that we asked in that earlier show, you know, what was it that prompted this project and this effort to memorialize this group of men and people who were involved in this project, and why now?
Well, you know, part of it is the fact that I live right there. I hear the trains coming through. I hear the train whistles coming through as they're getting ready to go into the Swannanoa Tunnel. And so I'm around this area all the time. I hike and bike in that area. And ever since I moved there about 5.5 years ago, I being aware of the history, I don't go near those tracks without thinking about the fact that while those tracks represent a lot of progress and the opening up of Western North Carolina, they also represent a mass burial site and are the legacy, the ongoing legacy of the labor of these and the unwilling, in most cases, unwilling sacrifice of these people, but extreme sacrifice. And so, but there's just very little indication of that. And so I was thinking about that. And then I think the whole George Floyd murder and the Black Lives Matter and the whole discussions about memorials, I think, got me to thinking that there's really nothing to commemorate this. And this is so important. And so I reached out to Steve, and I knew that Steve had a deep interest and felt much the same way. And then things just kind of took off from there. So I'll let Steve explain his interest in this.
Sure, Dan. My interest began truly a little more than 50 years ago when I read John Ely's book, The Road, for the first time the year it came out, 1968. I was partly drawn to that book because the topic was so fascinating, but also the location of the book was an area that I knew, Ridgecrest, what is now called Ridgecrest, from years being at that summer camp. That's where I met Dan, by the way, back in the late 60s, early 70s. But I've been researching that since 1971, fully researching. And here it is 50 years later. You have to think about why was the railroad even built? Now, originally back in the 1830s, the leadership of the state of North Carolina had a very material reason for wanting to have the railroad go all the way to Tennessee. And that's because they wanted to promote and enlarge and increase the business of the ports of North Carolina. And the great opportunity that lay beyond the border, the undiscovered West, which in those days was Tennessee and the Ohio Valley, the Tennessee Valley, to bring in materials and minerals and who knows what all good stuff.
You're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. We are going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment. Again, you're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. Marcus and I are in another conversation, a rich conversation with Dr. Dan Pierce and Mr. Steve Little, the mayor of Marion, North Carolina, about the Rail Project, a project to memorialize the African-American workers and who helped to build the Western North Carolina Railroad. And as we were ending, Steve was giving us a really good history of the development of this railroad and what prompted the development of this railroad. Marcus, I'm going to let you jump in here because I know I can tell by your expression that you've got a question.
Yeah, and well, you know, when I think about the story of the incarcerated laborers who essentially built the Western North Carolina Railroad and about how that story is not well known, I'm both surprised and I'm not surprised, right? Because we know that this kind of forced labor among incarcerated black convicts was fairly common in the second half of the 19th century, especially after radical Reconstruction. And so I guess something I'm wondering, Dan and Steve, as historians, Why is memorialization important, right? I think Dan, you started to touch on this earlier in your comments, but thinking more broadly, you know, why do you, from a historian's perspective, why is it valuable to memorialize this sort of this particular effort, right? And especially given that, you know, I don't know of many projects like this, right? That really sort of recognize and honor the labor that African Americans who were sort of forced to work under the convict leasing system did after Reconstruction. So if that question makes sense.
And Dan, before you and Steve jump in there, I just want to say how important this question that Marcus is raising is, especially in if you can, either of you can respond to this. And when you think about the controversy around memorialization that we're dealing with right now, you know, I think that makes Marcus's question here, I think, so much, at least for me in my mind, so much more important. But please jump in here.
Well, one of the things that was important to me is because there has been this conversation and a lot of action actually in terms of taking monuments down. But I thought that we needed the other side of that conversation, Marcus, that says, okay, we're taking these down. What should we put up? And I guess part of me, you know, being, I don't know, a big believer in gratitude. I mean, you know, and that's part of why we memorialize things, to express gratitude. And also we put memorials up to express sorrow and remorse over things that have happened. You know, we memorialize the dead. And that's an important thing here, because again, it was a wonderful thing and a tragic thing in how it happened. And that needs to be acknowledged. And I think one of the things, Marcus, that you referred to earlier is the importance of remembering. If we're going to move forward as a society, you know, maybe there are things that we will eventually forget, maybe, but in the process, unless we confront those things in the past. And again, I think, you know, how do you heal? You know, you say you have to acknowledge the pain and you have to acknowledge the sacrifice and you have to acknowledge the cost. And so this was very important to me that be acknowledged and recognized.
Steve.
You know, the people who were in charge, they've been recognized. Andrews Geiser, that's named for Colonel Alexander B. Andrews. He wasn't involved in the Mountain Division, but he was involved in the Western North Carolina Railroad. Major James W. Wilson, he has a relatively small monument, but he's got one, and it's been in place since the 1920s. But people do not know, as a rule, how the railroad got here. The railroad lasted for roughly 100 years as a major, major development point of all of Western North Carolina. Mm. Until the railroad was created and built in Western North Carolina, there was no dependable transportation. If you wanted to go from the little teeny village of Asheville to the little teeny village of Marion, you could plan on about a 2 to 3 day travel time, and it would be partly by stagecoach. And if you're lucky, the stagecoach would not be caught in the mud coming down the mountain between Black Mountain and Oldfort. But if it did get stuck in the mud, guess what? Passengers, you get out in your fine clothing and you push in the mud just like everybody else to get this stagecoach back on the way. It opened up Western North Carolina. And who did it? Who did it? You think about the issue of slavery, and you think how horrible it was to treat humans as equipment, as tools, as personal property. And then you think about, well, this was after slavery, so these were convict laborers. And then you think, which is worse? There's no question which is worse. Convict laborers, That was worse than slavery. The slave owners had an investment to protect. They would only push their hired hands, so to speak, their employees, their slaves, to a certain point. They didn't want to risk their lives because they wanted them to work. So therefore, they would make sure they had a little bit of warmth in the wintertime, and enough to stay alive, and food enough to eat. On the contrary, when they were convict laborers stuck upon the side of the mountain in these stockades, they were nothing but pieces of equipment. There was no investment to protect because they were replaceable, and they would be pushed to the point of death.
And Steve, I think you really have addressed a point here that I was thinking about, and I was going to ask because the Western North Carolina Railroad was so important to the economic development of Western North Carolina. So it was not just the ports in the eastern part of the state of North Carolina, but the western part of our state benefited greatly from the construction of this railroad. And then I want to thank you for a point that you made about, because Marcus, it just reminds me of many of the conversations that you and I have had about respecting and honoring the ancestors, right? This is something that I have learned deeply from you. And I can't help, Marcus, but think here as well from thinking about the comments that both Steve and Dan have made here about what James Ferguson has said in these conversations that we're now having around, especially in Asheville, the reparations issue. And James has said that we need to deal with the reputational wound that these experiences have had on the people who went through those. And he believes that not until we deal with those that issue of the reputational wound, we're not going to be able to really move forward. So Dan, I think the point that you made really speaks powerfully to the point that James Ferguson, you know, who's a native of this region as well, you know, attorney, civil rights attorney in Charlotte, but it speaks, I think, powerfully to the point that he's been making. Marcus, I don't know if you want to address that, but I think, you know, it's a powerful point.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, this whole issue of the reputational, the reputational wound, I agree. As it relates to sort of confronting the past, wrestling with it, moving forward, and this is just my perspective. I don't know that it's possible to move forward unwounded, right? I don't know that a kind of once and for all healing is achievable, right? I think once people really are confronted with the brutal truth, for example, of how this railroad was constructed, about the lives that were lost inhumanely in order to ensure the completion of the railroad. And again, this is just one small episode in a longer history of inhumanity in this country. I don't know that the country ever heals from that wound, but I do think that a decision can be made to kind of live as a wounded nation, right, with this history, and use that knowledge, that history as a way of better understanding ourselves. But having said that, I'm curious to hear from you, Dan and Steve. So where's the project now, right? I think we spoke earlier about some developments, but I'm curious to hear more about that, Dan and Steve.
Well, we are nearing, I guess, the end of phase one, I guess we would say. And it was really interesting when Steve and I first met on my porch and had breakfast and started talking about this on July 7th of 2020. I think, at least from my perspective, I'm thinking this is something we'll work on over the next several years. And we never really expected things to move as quickly as they have. But we were able to get permission from the town of Old Fort to put the memorial at Andrews Geyser. We were able to publicize the project and then raise money. And so we've raised a little bit over $15,000. And then we have recently commissioned a stonemason, Paul Twitty, to do the memorial itself, and then a memorial company. Steve can comment on a local Marion Memorial Company to do the memorial plaques, which will include names of some of the incarcerated laborers that that sacrificed so much to make this happen. So we're moving along, you know, and looking at an October, tentatively an October 17 dedication. So, Steve,
it's wonderful. And Steve, I would love to hear from you too, as you respond to that. You know, how has the community responded? In that earlier conversation with Dan, and then hearing the comments that Marcus and I have heard from many of our listeners, there's a great deal of enthusiasm. You've been able to raise this money. Were you surprised? And then you were able to get the town to go along with the construction of this memorial. Were you surprised that people were so, you know, ready to just jump in and get this work done? And I still think of that in the context of the controversy that we're currently dealing with around these whole issues of memory.
Yes, I was surprised. I still am somewhat surprised, because people, they've known that generally I'm well known as being a railroad enthusiast, but those who have heard me talk about it or seen the one man productions that I've done over the years know that these convicts, these incarcerated laborers, were almost exclusively African-American men. So in this cultural environment, for people to express enthusiasm and being pleased that this group of people that have had no spokesman for them forever, are going to be recognized and memorialized. So yes, I've been delighted and surprised.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I'm curious, Steve and Dan. And maybe this is a little bit premature. I know that the monument has not been completed just yet. But do you imagine that this memorial will have a significant impact on the surrounding community? Steve, you just talked about how, you know, you were sort of pleasantly surprised to see that there seems to be a receptivity in the community to remembering these laborers. Do you see the memorial having an impact, like a long-term impact on the kind of ethos of the surrounding community, raising awareness about this history and about other related histories during the same period, right? The second half of the 19th century, maybe even moving into the 20th century?
Marcus, that's a great question. And yes, I do. I do think this will have a significant impact, partly because Andrews Geyser, we carefully chose that as the location where we wanted the memorial to be. And that's sort of like the heart of the railroad. It's not in the middle, but it's sort of close to the middle anyway. But it's the only recognized spot that's on what used to be known as the Mountain Division. And it draws thousands of people every year. I've seen some old video things on YouTube of people coming up, taking pictures on vacation and saying, oh, wow, look at this. I wonder who Andrew was and why did he put his geyser out here? Mm-hmm. People who have no clue. Well, no. Now they're going to be able to go over to the memorial and they're going to be able to read a little bit about what this is and understand that this was a sacrifice of the highest order by people who worked under severely brutal conditions, under forced labor, because they had no choice.
Dan, I would love to hear your response to that as well. You know, were you surprised by the interest that people showed in the project and the openness to actually have this conversation? And I'm curious too, Dan, if you could both you and Steve, if you could share with the audience, because you said part of the memorial itself will have the names of some of the laborers who worked there. How did you find those names? You know, what went into that process of finding out who some of these men were?
Well, this came out of the work really of Ann Chesky Smith, who is the director of the Western North Carolina Historical Association. She previously headed up the Swannanoa Valley Museum. And while there, she did some research on this. And so she started digging and she found a couple of things, doing some newspaper searches. She got some names from newspaper reports, basically, of convicts who were shot trying to escape. So their names appeared in the paper at that. So we got a few names from that. Most of the names, however, came from the 1880 census. And so there were still, even though the railroad had been completed through that area, there were still stockades and work camps for these incarcerated laborers. And so, you know, and when the census comes around, some years politicians want to count people and some years they don't want to count people. This year, evidently, they want to count everyone. So that's where we got most of the names, was from the 1880 census. So, and that was a really important thing, I think, to all of us, that that we were able, we're not going to be able to put every, as Steve pointed out the other day, if we put all the names we have, they would be so tiny, you wouldn't be able to read them. And so we're putting a representative sampling of names. But that was very important for us to really acknowledge the humanity here, and that these were people.
You got to see their names. And when you see names, you know it's people. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it's too abstract a concept mm-hmm. to be brought home.
Yeah. And it's really, yeah. Go ahead, Marcus.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask a follow-up question to Dan, because when I was reading that, that many of the names had been culled from the 1880 census, I was thinking, whoa, someone actually decided to count people that year. And so I was just curious, Dan, what was it about that particular year that led to the decision to actually count people, you know, in a period where, you know, you couldn't necessarily count on a census to be accurate? Was there something peculiar about that particular year that led to this, you know, more, I guess, to a fairer counting?
Yeah, and Marcus, if I can, you keep asking great questions here, and it gives me the opportunity to make another point about Dr. Pierce.
Okay.
And it's something that I hope that I can actually develop at some point, but Dan has a subtle and I would say brilliant way of saying something to make a larger point. and there was a larger point about this whole census thing, and I think of conversations that we're currently having so brilliantly to come back to it. But Dan, you know, bravo on being able to make that subtle point.
Well, and the answer to Marx's question, I'm not really sure, but you know, as we know in our current history, it probably had to do with redistricting. So that would be my suspicion as to why. And Republicans were in charge at that time, and so I think it probably was an issue of redistricting. But yeah, but that year they're going to count everybody in North Carolina.
Okay. Well, again, you're listening to the Waters and Harvest Show here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment. Again, this is the Waters and Harvest Show here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. Thank you for staying here with us. We are talking to Dr. Dan Pierce and Mr. Steve Little, the mayor of Marion, North Carolina, and we're talking about the Rail Project and this effort to memorialize the men who helped to construct the Western North Carolina Railroad. That project is nearing completion, at least in this first phase, as they have told us. And we just want to continue to find out what is going to happen next. But Dan, thanks again. As we went out into that break, you were making the point about, you know, being able to find these names and the names, at least the names of some people. And Steve, I think, you know, the names really do make people real. And I couldn't help but think about how powerful the Vietnam Memorial has been in Washington, D.C., simply because of the names that are there. And work that we've done here, Dan, here in Western North Carolina with the Slave Deeds Project, when you go in and you look at these deeds and you see names, it really makes the story very, very real. And if I can, this gives me an opportunity to just really give some maybe a shout out and props to the work that archivists, people in the archives do. I had recently the opportunity to visit the Western region of the state archives and was there as Heather South and an intern working through a whole new box of documents that they've gotten from Burke County that no one knew really existed, Steve. And there were records in there about the Western North Carolina Railroad. I saw this while I was there with them that was kind of like manifest of the rails being shipped to Western North Carolina. So these are new documents that people haven't seen. And I think that will offer, you know, a way to continue to enrich the story around the construction of this railroad. But, you know, as we kind of move forward with this, you know, Dan, can you describe, you and Steve describe a little bit, you know, kind of paint a picture for our listeners about, where the memorial will be located, you know, what actually inspired the design for the memorial it as well.
I'll turn that over to Steve.
Well, Andrews Geyser just seemed to be the appropriate spot for people who are curious and maybe have heard of it, maybe haven't. It is a man-made geyser. Just to answer your first question. To get to it, you go to Old Fort and you get on Old Highway 70 on the west side of town. It's very close to it's about 2 to 3 tenths of a mile west of the giant Arrowhead in the middle of downtown Old Fort. Turn right onto Old Highway 70, go 2.5 miles, go to Mill Creek Road, turn right, go 2 miles, and you're right there. And there's the geyser. Some days the water flows, some days it doesn't. Breaks my heart, but nevertheless, it isn't always dependable. But that still is the spot. When the memorial is dedicated, people will be able to stand and look at the memorial, and the train will be on both sides of them because it's in a loop, a great large loop of the railroad tracks. And what I genuinely hope is people will pause, listen to the sounds of nature, listen to the sounds of Mill Creek as it babbles by, and the sound of the mist of Andrews Geyser when the water is flowing, and read this and leave with a lump in their throat, perhaps tears running down their face. That would be very appropriate. I know that I will be like that.
Yeah, I have to say, as a scholar of religion, it sounds to me like this memorial may serve as a kind of sacred space, right, for the community and indeed for the state. I'm also curious to know. So who's involved? And I think we talked a little bit about the design of the project. I think this was much earlier. Maybe it was before the show started. But could you say a word about who's involved in the design and construction of the project?
Dan would be better at that. Dan, you take that away.
Okay. We were very fortunate in being able to contract with a local stonemason by the name of Paul Twitty. And Paul has, he lives in Old Fort, has deep roots in that community. And it may surprise folks that, that there has been a long lasting and very viable African-American community there in Old Fort. And so Paul, again, is kind of nearing the end of his career. And he was very excited about the prospect of this kind of being an important part of his legacy. So the memorial itself is, and Steve, I think, has the dimensions memorized better than I, but is about, what, 5.5 feet tall, maybe?
It's actually about 6 feet tall and about 5 feet wide. Mm. And it's native rock, some from the streams, some from just the ground. It's a masterful creation, a beautiful formative display, into which, in the center of which, the plaques will be inserted with an east front and a west front. We're not going to call either side the back. They're both going to be the front.
Right. Well, this is a wonderful description of how the memorial will look, and it's very, well, I'm very grateful, Dan, to know that Paul is involved with the project. Paul is someone who I know, and he's one of those people who has a servant's heart. And so he really does, serve, and he serves the community. And knowing that this is going to be one of his last project that he's going to do, I think makes it even more meaningful. Well, Steve and Dan, this has been a group effort. It's not just been the work that the two of you have done on this, but there's a larger group of folks who have been involved to help spearhead this and steer it to completion. Can you tell us about who some of those folks are?
Okay, well, one of the first things that Steve and I did was sit down and say, okay, who can we enlist or twist their arm or whatever, get involved. And actually, one of the first names we came up with was Darren Waters.
Okay. Amen. Amen to that.
I didn't give Darren much choice. So my wife hates to hear me say this, but just to irritate her, I'll say, Darren owes me. And so I was kind of, but seriously, his expertise in Western North Carolina and African Americans in Western North Carolina was very important. And so we had, a number of people who are historians, Ann Chesky Smith, again, Rowan Bishop, who is the site supervisor at the Mountain Gateway Museum. And is very knowledgeable, of course, about the railroad and about the incarcerated labor, all those issues. Ashley Whittle, who is in the UNCA Special Collections, who's from a railroad family and is from Old Fort, has been part of that. It was great. It's been great to have that historical expertise. Jeff Futch, who is with the Western Regional Office of Archives and History, again, added additional historical expertise, and then have community members as well. And so we had Jim Stokely, who was Wilma Dykeman's son, who actually wrote one of the chapters in the French Broad is about the Mountain Division and the construction of the railroad up the mountain. Mm-hmm. We really wanted, again, community members and so individuals from both counties. Ray McKesson, who is the head of the McDowell County NAACP, he is our vice chairman, and has just been an enthusiastic supporter all along the way, and very key. And then, very interestingly, we were able to recruit, and this wasn't intentional on the front end, but it is as it ended up, two African American police chiefs. And so Melvin Lytle, who is the chief of police at Old Fort, and Melvin was key at the Old Fort's kind of like Mayberry, and so it's a small town. And so Melvin is the police chief, but he's also on the board of aldermen, and so he really was able to very quickly help us get the approval of the Board of Aldermen to put the memorial at Andrews Geyser. So we're very much indebted to him. And then Eric Boyce, who is the chief of police at UNC Asheville, has been a key member of the committee. And Eric has that perspective of law enforcement, but also is a native of McDowell County and still has very strong roots in McDowell County. And so again, we, and of course, Steve, it's been a great group to work with. I don't know that I've ever tried to put together a group of folks where everybody I ask immediately agreed, if that was the case here. So we're very much indebted to the support and work of all of our committee members.
Yeah, I have to say, Dan, and maybe we can address this after the show, but I was very My ears perked up when you said that Darren owes you. I had no idea that Darren was running around out here with outstanding debts that have yet to be paid. So maybe after the show, Dan, we can discuss what my brother owes you.
Well, you know, I am, you know, Dan, you've just given him more ammunition, you know, but one of the things I'll ask, and you as well, Dan, is there still time for people who might be interested, who haven't been involved, to get involved in the project? And how can they do that?
They can donate. That is helpful because we do have more phases of our work that we want to get into. So yes, we want them first to be attentive to when the official date is announced formally for the dedication, and then come down to Andrew's Geyser and be there for that. But then we have some more work we want to do. We want to put up some wayfaring signs to supplement the memorial at Andrew's Geyser. Okay. We want to put up a wayfaring sign up at the Swannanoa Tunnel at the western portal, which is in Black Mountain. The eastern portal of the Swannanoa Tunnel is in McDowell County, western portal in Buncombe County. That tunnel, by the way, 1,832 feet long, 6 football fields end to end, had 2 crews working, one at each end. This was in the 1870s working, and when they met on March 11, 1879, the grade and the centers met exactly.
Wow.
Incredible. Wow. Incredible. And who did it? The incarcerated laborers who were not deemed worthy even to have their names recorded at the time.
Wow. And I'm curious, Dan and Steve, and this is just my own lack of knowledge about this project. Is the railroad still now as active as it was back then, or has it fallen into some disuse or what?
Well, yes. The last passenger trains were roughly 45 to 50 years ago.
Okay.
There's still freights every single day that go through the 7 tunnels of the Mountain Division. One of those tunnels is still just like it was completed by the incarcerated laborers with no concrete reinforcement. It is an awe-inspiring thing to see. But yes, it is still used. And quite honestly, with not enough people to drive trucks these days, I see businesses utilizing rail more and more. I think they'd be smart to do so.
Right. You know, Steve, you know, Marcus asked that question. That was going to be one of my questions. You know, what can we do to bring passenger rail back to Western North Carolina?
Yes.
I mean, in the eastern part of the state, you know, my son, Lewis, he loves to ride the train. And while he was a student at UNC Charlotte, you know, he would take the train from Raleigh. You can take it from Raleigh to Charlotte. But, you know, I would love it if you could get rail back to Western North Carolina. I mean, it's beautiful. I remember my grandparents would take us on the train when there was still passenger rail. And this would be in the 70s, probably the early and mid 70s. But each year, my grandparents, Ike and Geraldine Rice, would just to give us the experience of riding on a train. We would go into Biltmore Village, get on the train, and then, you know, take it down to Oakford. And then, you know, my grandfather would usually follow in the car and then pick us up and then bring us back. But it was just such a wonderful experience. I would love to see that come back to Western North Carolina.
Another topic for another day, maybe,
is
what is called the WNC Rail Committee, where my good friend, former State Representative Ray Rapp from Madison County, from Mars Hill, he and I have been co-chairman of that for several years. It involves a lot of municipalities and counties and organizations in Western North Carolina. And that is our goal, to improve freight and to restore passenger rail.
Well, if there's anything we can do to help support that, you know, I think, Marcus, I don't know about you, but I'm all in to help support that effort, Steve. And we want to thank you all for taking the time to come back and join us again for this conversation, to give us this update on where you are. And just for our listeners, if you want to support this project, you can go to the website, And the website is simply The Rail Project, and that is one word, therailproject.org. And there's a lot of information, some back history, some of the stories behind the construction of the railroad. I think you'll find it an enjoyable site to actually go visit, and you can actually donate there as well. Well, Dan and Steve, any final, one final thought that you have here as Marcus and I get ready to close out this show?
The single most important event of the development of Western North Carolina was the building of the railroad up the mountain. Nothing's compared.
Thank you, Steve. And again, thank you, Dan. You have a final thought.
Well, I just encourage folks to be on the lookout for the official announcement of our dedication. It's going to be a wonderful occasion. It's going to be a solemn occasion. We've talked about this, and it's also I think folks will very much benefit. And if you can't make it to then, after October, make the trip down the mountain and see the memorial. One thing again, Paul did such wonderful work. One of the really cool things he did were to incorporate rail spikes into the memorial.
And,
so it's just it's a work of art. It really is. So,
again, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your work, for helping to spearhead this project, and for moving the project forward. Congratulations on that. And again, as we conclude this show, Marcus and I want to remind you that the Waters and Harvest Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina, in partnership with the Institute for the Promotion of Human Understanding.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, the BPR and NPR One mobile apps, and on Apple Podcasts and Google Play.
You can follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter, or you can write us at whshow@bpr.org. And Marcus and I will look forward to joining you again next time. Thank you.
Take care.